That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome back to an all-new episode of Surf Splendor. I'm your host, David Scales. Thanks again for tuning in. Before we get into today's show, I'll bring you up to speed on what's been developing around here. Basically, the show is growing, and we need help. We've got an internship available at Surf Splendor, so if you have a passion for surfing and storytelling, we could really use your help. It doesn't matter where you live. We can work through email and over the internet. So everything about the job qualification, requirements, and how to apply is on our website, surfsplendorpodcast.com. Basically, it's an associate producer position. We need someone who can transcribe interviews, edit, help with scheduling of interviews, kind of a highly organized person to help cover the bases here. So if you're interested, visit surfsplendorpodcast.com for all the details. And if you're new to the show, Surf Splendor is basically just conversations about surfing. Simple as that. If you're listening on iTunes and Stitcher, you can leave ratings and show reviews there. All past episodes are archived for free. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Surf Splendor. Find us on Facebook. I've previously been asking that if you like the show, to share it with a friend. I'm going to ask you to do it in a little bit more practical way this week. Go to our website, surfsplendorpodcast.com, and send one friend an email or a Facebook post with a link to our website. It's basically your way to invest into the show. The more people listening, the more shows we'll be able to produce in the future. Sound good? We'll keep cranking out shows as long as you keep sharing them. So thanks so much for listening. That's enough of my sales pitch. We've really got a packed show for you today, so I won't keep you any longer. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show. Santa Cruz is just a rad little surf town. It doesn't have all the limelight and industry attention of Southern California, but it quietly serves up superior waves in a wide range of conditions, everything from small sloppy beach breaks to hollow reef breaks to the giant waves of Mavericks. It's a proper, old-fashioned surf town where surfers wear black wetsuits and they surf perfect waves without ever posting it on social media. Someone once told me that there's more shapers per capita in Santa Cruz than anywhere else in the world. And while I'm not really sure if that fact is substantiated, the point still stands. There are a lot of shapers in Santa Cruz. As much as it's a surf town, it's also a working class town. And if you like surfing, and if you know how to work with your hands, it's probably only a matter of time until you try to craft your own board. Today on Surf Splendor, we bring you conversations with four such individuals. As part of our ongoing Shaper series, we tried to pick a cross-section of shapers that represent four different personalities, styles, and shaping philosophies. We have Steve Coletta of Natural Curve Surfboards, Michelle Junod, Ward Coffee, and Bob Pearson of Aero Surfboards. These interviews were recorded in April 2013 in each of the shapers' respective shaping bays. They were mic'd, I was not, so I apologize for the compromised audio quality. First up, Steve Coletta. Natural Curves Surfboards is hidden in an industrial building in an agricultural suburb of Santa Cruz. As I wandered around looking for the sign, I spotted a man with white and silver hair and a full beard that was being smashed by his pulled down shaping mask. He greeted me with a wide smile and instantly began telling me about the recent weather. I usually try to refrain from even casual conversation until the mics are heated up, but there was no stopping him. 10 minutes passed before I was able to pull out the microphone. I pressed record and asked him how he got involved in surfing. He laughed and said, "That's a dangerously open-ended question. I've been known to ramble." I told him I appreciate the warning, but while that may sound daunting to a writer or an editor, it would be perfect for the podcast format. So, without further ado, I give you Steve Coletta.
My dad was a minister, okay? So he moved around a little bit like as if it was a military thing.
Okay.
And so I was born in Alameda, which is up here on the bay. And I think, I can't remember quite the years and stuff, but in the late 50s, I ended up with my parents down in Los Angeles someplace, you know? And actually, we were out at, we would go to the beach, go body surfing and stuff when I was a little kid, you know? And I think I was about 8 or 9 years old, and we were at this place called Seikos, and I saw these, it's just north of Malibu.
Okay.
And I saw these guys riding longboards. I was just going, oh man, this had to be about 56 or 58 or,
wow.
You know, it's a long time ago. And I was blown away. So I just go, I don't know, something, that was the moment,
yeah.
I suppose, when I said, that's something I want to do,
yeah.
I suppose, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just absolutely, huh? The guys are walking on water. It's phenomenal, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, my dad and I, all we would do is swim, body surf, and get, you know, sand in our ears and stuff.
Sure.
Yeah, which is pretty fun.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I remember he moved, my parents moved to the coast, to Palos Verdes in 1959.
Okay.
And I remember my dad, there was this older kid in church, you know, I think I must have been 11 or something like that. Anyway, there was this older kid in the church that said he was going to take me surfing. I was just over the moon. I was going, oh man, at last, you know. It had probably been 6 months since I'd seen surfing the first
mm-hmm.
time, and turned out we went body surfing.
Oh,
so
okay.
I was going, oh. And that actually, you know, that actually maybe wanted me to do it more,
sure,
you know. So I don't know.
Was there like a cultural awareness of surfing? I mean, did you see it on TV and that sort of thing, or was it?
No. It was. Yeah, I had not seen it on TV.
It was totally fresh.
Yeah, just was.
That's
and I really almost can't remember, but sometime in 1959, I went to. Somehow or another, I ended up at Portuguese Bend, which is the south side of Palos Verdes, there towards San Pedro, at the beach with a longboard one day. And that was my first surfing experience. I don't know where the board came from, how I got to the beach. My parents obviously took me and something like
sure.
that, you know. And there's nobody around. And one kind of grumpy guy said, you know, kid, if you want to learn how to surf, you got to go over to the South Bay and surf Rat and Torrance Beach and stuff like that. So kind of got the boot from the Bend before
yeah.
I could
nice
even stand up.
Yeah,
you know. And so that was the start of it. And and it was kind of weird. My parents were wonderful people. They were intellectuals, white-collar people. My dad was a minister. My mom ended up being a psychologist. And they weren't into the beach culture that much, you know? And so that, once again, made me want it more. And
sure.
by the time I was, you know, old enough to get rides to the beach with my friends and get a driver's license and stuff as a teenager and stuff, you know, I was gone, stoked. and but about 1966, 1967, we were kind of getting out of the LA Basin and surfing wherever we could and stuff, and we were running into Greeno all the time in Santa Barbara and on the ranch. And it was, and you know, everybody was on longboards, and Greeno was on cut down things and doing, you know, he wasn't trimming, you know, he was turning, and that intrigued me dramatically. And then at the same time, we started here, we saw this Nat Young, Bob McTavish thing coming off of the Australian, whatever you call it, Australian surf culture.
Yeah.
And like Nat won that world contest in San Diego at Ocean Beach, where, you know, the California Hawaiian guys were just awesome nose riders and stuff. And here's Nat, he was hanging five, hanging 10, then he'd backpedal and do these insane carving cutbacks and figure eights and stuff, you know? And so I think that was introducing, you know, somehow or another the Greeno thing and the Australian thing got together. And I heard the story from Greeno was that he was watching fish in an aquarium in Santa Barbara or someplace in Southern California, and he noticed the speed of tuna and the speed with which they turn and stuff, you know? And he's going, you know, I think surfing could go that direction instead of like the beautiful kind of pelican skip fry thing gliding right on the updraft. I mean, you know, wow, what could be cooler than that kind of trim, you know?
Yeah.
Except for a gouging bottom turn by an elite pro, you know? So,
interesting.
Both beautiful worlds, both.
Totally.
And
Steve then told me about how he got involved with board building.
We couldn't get the boards that we saw the guys that we wanted to emulate our surfing after, because the major brands were still producing, you know, 10-foot longboards that weighed 30 pounds.
Okay.
So we started stripping them and going around to various, we went to this place, Foss Foam. There was a couple of alternative foam companies and stuff like that, because I don't think Grubby would sell us foam as being kids and backdoor not being in business and stuff. But anyway, we were just making boards in our garages and stuff for a couple of
just
years there, 66, 67, 68. Yeah, and we would get some foam. I remember we got Foss Foam, was, of all things, I don't know, it's back there in the archives someplace, and he was in Long Beach someplace, I think, you know?
Okay.
And I remember kind of dropping out of college after 4 years in 1969, and it was the end, it was springtime, and I was going, man, I really want to go on a surf trip, you know? And I saved up a little cash and stuff, and I was going, God, I can't go to Hawaii, it's going to be flat, you know? And we had seen John Witzig's movie that I think he filmed in 68 called Evolution, and it fit right into our thing about the boards we wanted to ride and stuff, and it was all about surfing in Europe and stuff. So we went, wow, let's go to Europe.
4 years into his 5-year college program, Steve packed his bags for what was scheduled to be a short trip to Europe. In Europe, he had the chance encounter that would end up heavily influencing his career path. Steve refers to him as Diff, but you may know him as Mike Diffenderfer, the man who named what would ultimately become the world's most famous surf spot, the Banzai Pipeline.
And I met this guy, I met Diff in Europe in 1969. And he became kind of a major influence on me in terms of design and work habits. I mean, there were some kind of interesting, intriguing, leading edge people hanging out there, you know, that were, as being a little kid, I was 20 years old, I was going, sponge, please, you know, let's absorb some of this stuff. So Diff was actually shaping backyard boards there at the time. And, you know, anybody who got a Diff was just fired up, you know. And the funny thing was, I didn't come home on schedule and stuff. I kept hanging out and this and that. And finally dragged myself home around December or something. After, I think I left in May that year, so it was a nice 6 or 8 month trip or something, you know. We got to surf in North Africa and Morocco and stuff on that trip.
Wow.
It was pretty cool. Yeah, before cords, which was very interesting,
yeah.
You know. But so how's this? My folks sent me to a shrink, right?
Oh,
they go, so
wow.
What's wrong with this guy, you know? And the shrink's report was, there's nothing wrong with this guy. He just needs to continue his education on the coast.
Yeah.
He can't go to school in downtown Los Angeles, you know.
But Steve did go back to school. He transferred down to UC San Diego, where he met up with his new friend, Mike Diffenderfer, who was now working down there.
I had such a good time in Europe a couple years before that when I finished school, I packed my bags and went on a surf trip to Europe again, you know?
Wow.
And interestingly enough, that year, Diff was the guest shaper at Barlon's.
Perfect.
And so he was pounding out all kinds of foam. And and this is where the kind of natural curves came from.
Okay.
And Diff had been in South Africa that same year, and in Durban there was I think he had had a significant influence at Durban and Jeffreys Bay, and there was a group of guys there that Diff had this thing, you know, like, you know, he talked about natural curves a lot in outlines and rockers and stuff, and so there were some groms in Durban that said, Diff said, hey, you know, start up, call yourself Natural Curves, you know, and he said the same thing to me, so. You know, there you go. That's where
the
name.
Did the Grohl's in Durban ever run with it? Or?
Yeah, I think they did. And I think their business has been and come and gone a couple of times. And
really?
I noticed them, I Googled them recently, and I noticed that they kind of specialize in retro boards with really beautiful resin art, gloss and polished finishes and stuff. But as opposed to, say, Spider Murphy out of Durban, who's just, you know, doing what I've wanted to do all these years, you know, making glass slippers that or the cat's meow, you know?
Yeah.
But... So yeah, I hung out with Diff, and actually he and a handful of South Africans and I lived in this house in Southwest France. Diff would work and we'd surf, and Diff would surf. And
yeah,
it was a great time. It was pretty darn cool, you know. And actually, those guys were all gone and stuff. And I ended up getting a job as a caretaker at a campground there, right by this kind of reef point break, I met my wife that year as well, right? You know, and I just hung out, and in the middle of that winter, we got married and moved to Santa Cruz.
Okay.
And so here I was in Santa Cruz, kind of going married, going, well, I guess I better get serious here.
Yeah.
And so Natural Curves became the serious side of being a kind of a product of that kind of really pivotal evolutionary little moment in surfing there where we decided we were going to do the George Greeno thing and go really fast and do crazy turns as opposed to just necessarily trimming and going really fast and stuff, you know?
I then asked Steve about his brand, Natural Curves, and how it fits in among the many board builders in Santa Cruz.
Well, you know, the goals go right back to Diff. Diff said there's only one way to do anything, and that's the right way, you know? Pretty simple stuff, you know? And so actually, my goal has been, you know, geez, gosh, answering a question like that almost sounds like a marketing thing, you know, like that. But my early on and throughout the entire shaping career, you know, my goal has been to shape the best board I possibly can, to not waste a piece of foam, you know. Mm-hmm. Take that piece of foam and whatever it's supposed to be, you know. Make it as executed as well as I possibly can. Then, you know, I guess maybe 20, 30 years into my career, maybe around the year 2000 or so, it dawned on me that the boards, you know, what I build and myself and the whole, the business side of it too, is a brand, you know? And I'm going, whoa, geez. So at that point in time, it started to become important to me to honor the brand, you know? As much as I honored the product, but I think that was happening naturally anyway, you know?
Sure.
And then the third phenomena, which is just so essential, is and it comes out of the concept of lean production. I didn't even realize I was into lean production, but I am, you know? It's all about the client. First and foremost, we're a team that provides something for the client,
right?
You know? And on the line or the production line, we all get together and do our best, not only for the client, but for the other people on the team, so that it's, so that, you know, it's not a difficult thing to take care of the client.
To learn more about Steve Coletta, go to naturalcurvesboards.com or come over to our website, surfsplendorpodcast.com, where we have links to all of Steve's information. Next up is Michel Junot. His boards couldn't be more dissimilar to Steve Coletta's. Michel makes a bit of everything, from short boards and fish to logs, but they are almost always adorned with gorgeous colorwork and gloss jobs. In our discussion, we discuss his history and design philosophy, but one thing that we didn't discuss that's worth noting is his role in Thomas Campbell's film, The Present. In the film, Campbell documents Michelle's trip through West Africa, surfing with Alex Nost and Dave Rostovich. It's a beautiful film and well worth seeking out. And the only reason I bring it up is because I think it's important to recognize Michelle's exquisite talent as a surfer in order to fully appreciate the work that he's doing as a shaper.
Got my first board in 1962, and it was kind of trippy. I was always the smallest guy in my class, or one of the smaller guys in my class. So I think 13 when I started surfing, and I couldn't get my arm around any of the boards.
Oh,
all like 9, 6, 10 foot, you know.
Right.
So I went down to Jacobs and ordered a custom-made 710 by 20 inches wide, and it was a perfect replica of, you know, a wood fin, glass on, wood fin, 3/4 inch redwood. If I had that board today, it'd be priceless.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so cool. So, you know, I grew out of that, and then I got an 810 Dave Sweet and an 810 Dewey Weber, and then I got on the Challenger surfboard team out of San Diego.
Oh, okay.
Met the guy that built those back in the day. And that led to my shaping experience because I was on a surf team. And in 1966, I went to the East Coast because he had moved his whole operation to the East Coast instead of shipping boards in the West Coast. He's still there today. He's not making boards anymore. Guy Carl West.
Mm-hmm.
And so I spent 66, 67, 68, those summers building boards on the East Coast. And so that was really fun. That was, you know, surfing was huge right then until shortboards came in. I tell people this, they don't believe it. When longboards went out in 1967, 68, and shortboards came in, 80% of the people quit surfing.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally. Because most of the guys were older, and they couldn't transition to the smaller boards, and they were transitioning into married life, or going to Vietnam, or whatever the situation, you know, all these things were happening in the late 60s, and a lot of people just transitioned out of it. You know, Phil Edwards stopped surfing. Because he didn't transition to it. A lot of guys did.
What was his, rationale, though? I don't want to ride a shortboard?
I don't know what his rationale was, but he didn't. He was kind of a recluse guy anyways,
yeah.
Just kind of in general. But, I mean, you know, he's one of the best. And a lot of guys transitioned, but a lot of guys didn't.
Yeah.
And a lot of surfboard companies went under because
there just
wasn't the sales. And a lot of younger guys like me started making boards kind of underground.
Mm-hmm.
And so it changed that whole time. You can ask, I don't know if Kim was working way back then. I don't think she was working for Grubby way back then. But they had to change their whole thing, too, because of the amount of boards they were making.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously all new molds and all new size blanks and all that stuff. And that kind of transitioned over about one or two years, that whole thing transitioned, you know.
Yeah.
Michelle ended up back home in Southern California. When a friend mentioned that there was a shaping job available in Santa Cruz, Michelle loaded up his car and drove north.
So that was, this place was really the Wild West then. The surf leash wasn't invented yet.
Yeah, yeah.
So because of that whole thing, you know, people only surfed at certain tides and there was hardly anybody up here anyways. And it was like, I went, this place is crazy. And then came in like late winter, early spring. And then south swells came and I went, there's south swells up here. Because if you look directly out from this side of Monterey Bay, you look south,
okay.
So we get northwest coming around the corner and south directly out. So it's pretty much like the coastline at Malibu or Point Doom, same kind of a coastline thing.
You weren't bothered by the cold water?
No, we had okay suits. I mean, nothing like now.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was really good surf and nobody around. I mean, literally on the weekdays when kids were in school, there'd be 6, 5, 2, none people out, you know,
at
Steamer Lane. Yeah, really good waves. And then in 74, I moved to the North Shore.
Oh,
and
good.
Yeah, and I worked for Lightning Bolt, for Dick Brewer, and for Surfline Hawaii. What was going on back then is that the boards were all made in the North Shore by the surfers, and we brought them to town and sold them in Honolulu,
the
stock boards. And then we did a lot of custom stuff on the North Shore. But it was almost like two worlds of the town, you know, situation. But almost all the boards were built by guys on the North Shore. And then we, you know, run them in and get paid and run them back out and surf and stuff.
We then talked about the boards he makes now and how they're related to the boards he made 30 years ago.
You've probably noticed what's happened in the last 10 years of this ride anything movement.
Yeah.
And there's been all this stuff of going back to the 60s and back to the 70s and making different style boards, and even, you know, back to the 30s and making, you know, displacement hull kind of things.
Right.
The Simmons boards and all this different stuff. So there's all this stuff out there. And so in the period between 1967 and 1970, we were just really learning what shortboards were, because they're what they weren't before.
Yeah.
And so they were all different styles, from kind of eggy ones to super gunny ones. I mean, the guys in Hawaii were riding 17-inch wide boards.
Really?
Yeah, just full, pew, just stiletto things. But they had the waves. But they still, they went too far in that direction. Other guys went too far in the eggy direction or the hull direction and stuff. So because I like to surf big waves, and because I like going fast and I don't like the eggy type of boards, my design thing went towards the gunny side of the boards. And what you see in all the magazines from the 70s, the Hawaiian style boards were boards that were 19 inches wide, 18 and a half, 19, 19 and a half inches wide, a wide point up, very pulled tails. That was the kind of style of boards I did. As they got shorter, we got them wider, of course. They weren't super narrow. Well, going, you know, kind of going back in the longboard era, we weren't really too tuned in to why things weren't. I mean, really, the boards were pretty round rail, and, you know, they were great old logs. When shortboards came in, there was a lot of, you know, communication going on with shapers, with surfers all the time, because the boards were so new. And it, looking back at it, you know, it was almost like looking at, you know, race car history. And you go way back and you see the, you know, the big wheels and no fenders, yeah, and just this tub, and they're driving along. And then everything gets more and more streamlined. Then you have these space cars, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like that as far as aerodynamics goes, because we just felt really stoked that the boards were short and we could turn them so much better than longboards. But still, they were terrible,
yeah,
you know, considering what we got now, the rockers and the... And just the rails and just the whole, the weight and all that stuff came down. All the, so much change in surfing.
Yeah.
Just because we were able to think a little bit outside the box more and more and more. And I think that the surfers, not the shapers, pretty much pushed the design. There's been a lot of good shapers who've surfed, but way more good surfers who don't shape.
Right.
And so they've kind of pushed the design thing all the way along. And, for me, I've always, you know, I've been able to surf too, and so that really helps. I've noticed along the way that the best shapers who didn't surf always made sure that they had a good team around them, mm-hmm, that helped them do that, or else they weren't very good surfers, and they took others' advice as to what, you know, going on. I think sometimes they felt maybe threatened that, you know, okay, if I'm going to work with these guys, they're going to learn what I'm doing. They're going to start on their own.
There's always that.
It was that kind of a thing, you know. But yeah, it, just working with surfers has been incredible, and also working, like you said, with return customers.
Yeah.
And so also what happens is you end up building people quivers, because wherever you are, unless you're in just terrible surf conditions, you can ride everything from 1 foot to 10 foot. So you need different boards for different kind of waves.
Right.
And so what I've, you know, what I've taken in my experience is that whether I'm shaping a longboard or a shortboard, I incorporate what I believe to be, you know, the best rails, the best rockers, the best bottom contours, and all those things. I know what makes things, what designs work which way.
Mm-hmm.
And I know how to incorporate them in certain ways in boards that sometimes people wouldn't think would be that way. For instance, I made a lot of high-performance longboards about 20 years ago that had concave bottoms, double barrel concaves, all these things were happening in the shortboards. And that really helped them become performance-oriented style boards. But now I make a lot of logs with round bottoms and stuff like they were back in the 60s. So it all depends what somebody wants. If you want to ride 1 to 2 foot waves, 3 foot waves, and a nose ride, I'm going to make you a completely different board than if you want to ride a long board, you know, and up to 5-6 foot surf.
Right.
Or the same thing with a shortboard. If you want a board that catches a million waves, like this little brown thing over here.
Sure.
It's a big, thick plug thing that, you know, a 200-pound guy can go out and surf. But if you're a 150-pound guy, you're going to want something thin, you know,
right,
something small. And the way that this whole Ride Anything movement in the last 10 years has developed, I think, is really helpful in that you're able to take a lot of stuff from the past. I do that, but I modernize it.
Mm.
I'm not really into, hey, I want to replicate some of these boards from the late 60s, early 70s. They're dogs.
Right.
They work terrible.
Totally.
You know, and you know, hot young surfers can go out and ride them better than we rode them back then, because their mind is so much more open to different kinds of surfing that we didn't have when we were, you know, back in the 60s and 70s. But, you know, I really kind of refuse to copy a board if I think it's a dog.
Yeah.
You know, and some guys come, hey, man, and I say, well, look, can we talk about this a little bit and try to refine it a little bit?
Yeah.
And that happens once in a while. Or I'll get somebody that has an engineering background. They think they know stuff.
Yeah.
And have to be kind of careful not to insult them, but at the same time go, you know, that's not going to work. And
I mean, I've wondered about that too, where people, clients or surfers, are more knowledgeable now than they have been in the past because of the internet, I guess.
Of course.
And design forms, and you can just read up on it. But that doesn't mean they know what's good for them as surfers. You know, everybody thinks they want to ride what Dane Reynolds is riding, but it's like, nobody surfs like Dane Reynolds, so it's really...
No, it's really true. And my clientele is mostly, you know, some early 20s guys, mostly mid-20s to guys in their 60s. You know, guys who can still surf good, but they're not going to go do aerials.
Yeah.
They're not going to just, you know, there's no tubes around here, you know what I mean? You know, this isn't Indo.
Right.
And so a lot of boards I'll build for guys is, you know, boards that catch waves well, that are still maneuverable. And I only use green foam usually. I hardly ever use blue foam or the red foam because I want strong boards. And guys come to me for a beautiful looking glass job and a sturdy board and one that'll work in all kinds of conditions. And so I kind of have that kind of clientele more than, you know, the rusty thing and the Channel Island thing. And, you know, like, for instance, Steve and I are contemporaries. I make completely different boards than Steve. He makes completely different boards than me in general. I'll make a thruster now and then and stuff, but he doesn't make longboards, you know. And I have a lot of people that I get on the internet with, and they're kind of blown away that I spend time with them and talk about the shape. And I've always done that. I've always spent a lot of time with people, you know, talking about their surf history. It's almost like when you go to, you find a new doctor and they want to know your medical history.
Yeah.
The same kind of thing. I want to know people's surf history. It's really important. I want to know where you're going to surf. I want to know what kind of boards you're on. Bring your boards. I want to look at your quiver.
Right.
And without being too critical, I can look at a board and tell you how it's going to ride.
Right.
You know, and tell the guy, hey, well, we can change this. We can change that. And da 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 da. You know, that'll be a better deal for you. So.
Again, I'll have a link to Michelle's website as well as images of his beautiful boards on our website, SurfSplendorPodcast.com.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Ward Coffee began his career by working with Bob Pearson at Aero Surfboards in 1982. Bob will be our final interview in this episode. And that's the cool thing about Santa Cruz. Everyone has worked with everyone. In reality, they're all competitors in the marketplace, but nobody seems to view it that way. there seems to be an open exchange of information, and because of it, everyone's craft evolves and the surfing community benefits. We started our conversation with Ward telling me about one of the first boards he shaped and one session that helped launch his career.
And I was surfing that up at 4 Mile, and Bob Pearson from Pearson Aero saw me, said, "Hey, what are you on?" And we talked story a little bit, and he's like, "Oh, it's a neat board, you're surfing good on it." And introduced himself as a shaper and stuff. And so we kind of hit it off and kind of, you know, he started letting me hang out at his shop and watching him shape and stuff. And one thing led to another, and his brother ended up hiring me working at the surf shop at right here on Mission Street. And so I was working there in 1980, and just doing various jobs, but I was just watching Bob shape boards. And,
right.
And, you know.
Did he know that you were interested?
Well, he was totally hip, because he would make me a couple boards and we'd be in there shaping, and he'd go step out of the room to go do something, and I'd grab a tool and put the tool down.
Really?
And he's like, "Whoa, what's up?" You know, so he knew I was into it, and I was always watching, and I would watch Joey Thomas shape, and I'd watch a couple other guys shape, and any shaping room I can get into, I would kind of get in there and be a fly on the wall and hang out and talk story and do stuff. So Bob knew I was into it, and so we kind of came to agreement that he'd start teaching me to shape, and so he formally trained me as shaping. So around 82, we built a factory over here on Mission Street Extension. And we started going at it. He started training me, and I started being his production guy, ghost shaper.
Considering how collaborative the community of shapers in Santa Cruz is, I asked Ward if he often rides other shapers' boards.
Often?
All the time.
You do?
Yeah, I have no ego about that. I mean, I'll try them and go surf on them. It's not like they're in my quiver, you know? But
you're not like ordering boards from guys?
No, not really. You know, okay. I'd like to have Hout make me a board here or there, you know, it'd be cool. But I think it's fun. There's some neat boards. I mean, I've got this Mark Richards twin fin up there that I ride every once in a while. And I've got a couple other little tuckaway boards that I'll whip out and ride.
When was the MR shaped?
That was a production board. Probably Robin Perdanovich did that in probably 81 or 82. Okay. So it wasn't actually a real MR board, but okay. But there's other stuff. I think it's really neat to do that.
Seems like it would be equally valuable to your learning curve. You
know? Oh, totally. It's like these Skip Fry glider boards, like this blue one here.
Yeah.
Me and Thomas Campbell have worked on a bunch of these, and I've ridden his whole quiver of Skip's boards and run them through their paces and take all the dimensions off of them. And every once in a while I'll say, "Hey, dude, can I ride the 11-0 again and do it?" And so I've got a 10-6, I've got an 8-0 and an 8-6 of those. And the neat thing about those is when I, you know, you get all the dimensions off a board and you're just like, "Oh, I'm going to copy this board." But the reality is when you're shaping it, you start hitting these dots of how the shaper got to his evolution of how he, why do these contours come together? Why do these outlines come together? Why do the rails come together? It's not like I need to copy it to make it look right, but how did they get there? Mm-hmm. And like the skips were really good. I mean, the bottoms are these symphonies of contours. And I'm like, aha, I understand how that. And then we were out surfing and you go, I really understand. Yeah. Yeah. So that's really super valuable, man. That is the walking in the footsteps of the masters and the oration, or whatever you would say, of passing down knowledge, you know, I think that's more important than anything.
Right.
You know, I mean, I teach my kids that. I'm always giving away my kids. People come in and want to know, what about this or what about this? I'll say, get a piece of paper, get a piece of wood. I'll draw you a template and I'll write dimensions down on you. Then you go do it.
Right.
You know, if you need help, give me a call. I'll help you through it. So. I've always had that open door type thing, and I think everybody should.
I then felt inclined to ask Ward perhaps the most cliche question you can ask a shaper, and that is, what's his opinion on hand shaping versus machine shaping? The quick explanation for the uninitiated listener is that some shapers have boards cut and pre-shaped on a CNC machine. It saves them time and also allows them the ability to replicate boards with exact precision. Hand shapers often claim that machines have no soul, and the machine guys say that it's just a more efficient way to run your business. And of course, that the boards are then hand finished once they get off the machine. I asked Ward to share his thoughts on the topic.
So, My dad was a printed circuit designer in Silicon Valley.
Okay.
He did all the guts for printed circuitry. And so he was a draftsman by trade. And he actually had worked with AutoCAD when AutoCAD was in their infancy of just starting out. And he showed me, basically explained to me how that worked and what a Bezier curve is and that whole system of plotting numbers to create a curve or whatever. And I was like, yeah, that's cool. And then when I started shaping boards, and I showed him my first board shaped, and he's all like, oh, that's really neat, Warden. How are you going to reproduce that? I said, I just go in there and do it. But how do you get exactly to done that way? And I was like, you just do it. And he goes, the CAD system I'm working with these guys, we can do this, and you can get a CNC machine and cut it, you know? And we're talking back in 79, 80, you know? And I'm like, nah, there's no soul in that, Dad. No one wants it. Everybody wants a hand shape, you know? And he's all, well, just let me know, because me and my buddies, we can go to Ames Research and go to the scrapyard. We can put these things together. It'd be really a fun project. And I'm like, nah, there's no way, man. That's never going to happen. The machines are never going to take over, you know? So, 10 years of working at Arrow goes by. I learn my apprenticeship of how to be a production shaper. And, you know, I learned my skill, learned my trade, you know? Yeah. And then you go forward to now, and you see where the industry is now and how many boards are produced that way versus hand shape. So I'm kind of an idiot, but it's also, I'm kind of like, it's a funny little story that I feel kind of good about, because otherwise I really wouldn't have learned my skill set that I have right now. And using the planer is the one thing that I love more than anything in shaping. It's the one thing that I can put on street clothes and go and mow out of, because I have a vacuum to my planer, so I don't get dusty when I plane.
Yeah.
And my feel with the planer is I can get a board 85% shaped with the planer. Hmm. You know, I mean, there's a little sanding, a little stuff on there, but that's the part that I really like. Doing stuff on the computer would take that away from me. It would take that part of the shaping away from me, which I'm not really ready to let go yet.
Yeah.
You know? The scrubbing, the sanding, the fine tuning, I'm just like, that's...
Get a machine for that.
Yeah, exactly, you know. But when I look at a card or I talk to a customer about a board and we design a board or come up with a board, I know in here where it is, where we're going to go with it. I can walk in there and turn on my planer, plane it out, you know, have the template on it, plane it out, and get it, like I said, 80, 85% there and go, that's done. I've got the essence of that board in there. I've got it where I want it, you know? And so anyway, but you know, these arms aren't gonna work the same, and there's gonna be databases that I need to hand on to kids and things like that, so.
Lastly, I asked Ward about his eponymous label and the challenges of building boards one by one to suit an individual client's needs.
Well, being a custom shaper, that's, you know, it's part psychological, being analytical, giving the guys what they need and what they want together. That's the hard part, you know, because, you know, I keep track of the numerical, they keep track of the emotional end of things. And I try to keep a very definite separation of that. And I want what Dane rides. I want a neck beard or whatever. And, I can barely do a cutback. Yeah. And so you go, right on, okay, we can do it, I can do that, you know, but I've found, what I really, really, really found is that over the years, I keep really good records of all my boards. I was trained as a production shaper, so when somebody says, oh, I want a board you made 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, or last week, I can pull their file up, I know what blank I made it out of, what stringer arrangement, what density of foam, and all the dimensions. So I keep all that. It was really good. But what I've been learning more and more as far as being so anal about that is that getting the essence of that board, getting the essence of the whole package together, not just hitting those numbers exactly. And that's what a lot of times when guys are copying boards, or even the guys that are using machines a lot, is, yeah, they can do the same shape 10 times over, but why does a pro grab the board and feel it and look at it and pick one out of the five? Mm-hmm. There's an essence in there. And so it's just really trying to get that, trying to nail that a lot of times is what I'm finding, more so.
You have a unique opportunity in that your kids surf, you know, and you could shape boards for them.
Yeah.
So can you tell me about how that relationship is in terms of getting boards for them, getting feedback from them, but then also being able to do it over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. So you see them evolve as a surfer. Can you talk about that at all? I mean, what's that like?
Yeah, I mean, that's been like really the ultimate, because from a very little age to where they're at now, I've watched them surf and I can see certain things as they're developing. And I kind of waited for quite a while to start making them their real true custom boards. They were on foamies and they were on other things before I really started making them custom boards. And Ben, my older son, he's 15 now. So when I made him his first surfboard, you know, we just kind of made him a little board and he rode it. And he's kind of slender and upright. He comes from a longboarding background, both of them do. And so when he started shortboarding, he had a narrower stance and he surfed more upright, you know. And he's riding the long ways at indicators and down through the lane. And I'm like, gosh, he really needs to kind of crouch down a little bit. You know, he needs to bend his knees a little bit. So next board I built him, I put the wide point forward, put a little more foam up the front. Sure enough, he moved his foot forward.
Without even having to do it.
So that was a design thing that I was already like, I saw it. I thought of a board design. I thought of what we can do to help him do that. And we facilitated and did it. So we've gone through these different little evolutions of stuff, and so when I make them boards, they look at the boards and then they'll wax them up and they'll get fired up like kids do. But as soon as I see them riding a wave or whatever, I can kind of see or feel what is working and not working. You know, like sometimes I just go, "Oh, that's a miss, that's a straight miss," but I'm not going to say anything. And they'll ride the board and maybe they'll struggle and maybe they'll break through on it, but I'm like, you know, maybe he'll work himself into it and he'll be okay. But the feedback I'm getting now is insane, because as they're both growing, as they're both progressing, the feedback's really good just because they're ripping. But the main thing that's super cool is their hand-me-down boards are going to other kids, and I'm seeing these quantum leaps from these other kids on their equipment.
Really?
And because those kids are at where they were, so they're the control. But then seeing what's happening outside of the control and seeing kids make breakthroughs is really cool.
That's really cool.
You know, that's like the ultimate satisfaction that we're on track. We're doing good things. We're doing cool things to these boards. And that's on the performance shortboards. You know, what they're doing on longboards and on the Mini Simmons is crazy. You know, and they have they're lucky to have a dad that's into all these boards and throwing them boards all the time. And they've made a few and stuff like that. So it's kind of hard for us to go on surf trips because none of them just have one board they want to bring. There's going to be four or five boards that they're fighting over. I want to bring this. I want to bring that. I want to bring that. And so our car is loaded up with all these boards, you know, and, you know, we were just down south and, you know, we had long boards, we had our short boards, we had our Mini Simmons, you know, and they're still thinking like, well, what about, how come we didn't bring that board?
Right.
You know, because we surf Oceanside, we surf Trestles, and we surf San Onofre, you know, we were like going all around, you know, so that part of it's good. And it's the same thing. It's what any shaper, when they see a pro guy riding something and they make a design evolution, and they see a guy achieve a world title or whatever, it's that same thing, you know. And having your kids do it's even cooler.
Yeah, for sure.
Way cooler.
Totally.
All of Ward Coffee's information can be found on our website, surfsplendorpodcast.com.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
When I was a Grom, one of the most memorable images in my collage of surf magazines taped to my wall was an oversized poster of the infamous J. Moriarty Wipeout. The only logo on that giant board is that of Pearson Aero. The board was shaped by Bob Pearson. I became even more familiar with the logo through Flea and Barney, whom were featured almost monthly in magazines at the time, doing crazy airs and other antics. For me, the Aero logo became synonymous with Santa Cruz surfing. Our final interview this episode is with Bob Pearson. I began by asking Bob how he came up with the Aero name and logo design.
My first label was a red dot, and I came out with that at the same time Sam Hawk in Hawaii came out with it, and we looked at each other, oh, red dot, and I think both of us got off the same thing. I had red dot for about a year. And I was living in Hawaii for a while, and a buddy of mine, Lopez and Jack Shipley, came up with this lightning bolt, and they're walking around this big, long lightning bolt board from 100 yards away. You see this lightning bolt, and I thought, boy, that's a good marketing idea. So I thought an arrow. So I put arrows on my board. So I had all these arrows on my boards walking around.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and it worked out good. And so arrow, I like the idea of an arrow, and then Pearson arrow.
Yeah.
You know, like pace arrow and all that stuff. So the direction, the energy.
Right.
So it just went off in that direction. That's and that was early 70s.
I then asked Bob about some of those images from my youth of Flea and Barney doing crazy airs and how his board design evolution helped accommodate the modern surfing.
Kevin Reed, he was the first guy to do two airs. He was doing airs, and I remember Rusty Friesendorfer coming up to me and going, I heard about it. I can't believe it. I just was out there, and you just hopped over a couple guys and did all these airs. I was blown away.
Where was that at?
That was down at, we were down at a Huntington Beach surf surf contest there. But yeah, Kevin was the first guy to do airs, and I was just, he's phenomenal. I remember just fronting up to the beach, and I lived right there at Stockton Avenue. I came up there and looking out there, and Kevin was out there and standing with her by five, six guys. I'm watching Kevin just, it's a round hollow wave.
Yeah.
It's a shallow reef, and it's doing it. And he takes off first thing, does is whip around, does a backside aerial 360, lands and goes.
No,
I mean, guys have a hard time just taking off, making this thing.
Yeah.
And we sat there for a few seconds, just, you know, jaw dropping, looking at this and going, unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. You know, he was just so futuristic.
Bob is equally well revered for shortboards, longboards, and guns. He was also an early adapter to the stand-up paddle trend.
Stand-up boards, I'm working with Laird Hamilton right now.
I saw that.
Laird started the whole stand-up thing, and I've been making boards from day one. I was probably one of the first shapers in the world to start shaping these things. They're called stand-ups. In the very beginning, I was calling them Hoi Nalus.
Mm.
The word stand-up didn't exist, and so I'm making these things, and the whole factory were going, oh yeah, that's a Hoi Nalu, we're making these, and Laird's an incredible rider. I mean, I'm making him everything, for so many big variety boards, for small waves, to 100 boards for 100-foot waves, made him a balsa board for a 100-foot wave,
really?
And guns, and I'm making him finless boards right now, and the feedback, the energy, it's just incredible. I mean, I talk to Laird almost every day, and the fire up is just exciting. So
he seems like somebody who would be an effective communicator and knows what he's talking about when it comes to board design. Like he seems astute.
Oh, Laird's awesome.
He's
really intelligent. He really knows surfboard design. He's really into the R&D. He's really into making a better board. And everything works. What works better for what he's trying to do? And
right.
He's out there doing such a big variety of stuff. I'm making boards for Chopu, you know, for 1 foot wave Hanalei to 20, 30 foot Hanalei, you know, and everything's just, you know, Spreckles and Jaws and all these other waves. And I'm in the shape room a lot with Laird, you know, just doing the next board, you know. And
how did that relationship develop?
I went surfing a good buddy of mine, Bill Romanowski. He's was an NFL football player. Bill and I were going to go down south. He was friends with Laird, and we went down to go surf with Laird and went out there at Little Doom and met Laird. And I had a surfboard. Romo had a surfboard, and Laird had a like big Tana board with a...
Mm-hmm.
I was watching him, and at this point, Romo and I were sitting on the beach, and Laird's paddling, and I was just amused and laughing. I thought, how cool, some guy just getting on some sort of ridiculous thing, and jumping out there having fun. It's all about fun, and I go, I'm impressed with this guy. That's really neat. He's out there, and he made a wave from the first point to the second point to the third, and I was just out there, and I'm a good surfer, and I had a board that was fast, and I couldn't make the section, and he made this, and I thought, wow, what lucky he made that. It was amazing, you know, just a freak wave.
Yeah.
They went out there and did it again. I go, man, there's just, there's something about that board, that thing that makes, he can make a wave that I can't make on this thing. And he wasn't, no one was making section except for him. Right. And then he surfed on through right there, saw us, so he faded left, came to the beach, walked off, his hanging five, stepped off the sand, walked up to me, and I'm just, let me try that thing. So I grabbed his thing, went out there and tried it. And I was flopping around a bit.
Yeah.
Went out there, caught a few waves. All of a sudden I said, wow, this is fun. I'm seeing fish. I'm doing this. This is so new. This is so fresh. This is so different. So the learning curve, jumping on that. The workout was amazing. I was, that night I hurt from head to toe, my gut, my arms. I was going, what a workout.
Yeah.
And I go, well, I got to make one of these toys for myself. So there was again, I made myself one, then my friend one and his friend, and Larry's friends were this, and then go, the whole thing just went.
When was that, approximately?
You know, time is amazing for me. I can't believe, I always say, oh, there was a, you know, it's always twice, three times as long as I thought.
Yeah,
but that
yeah.
was right when I first came out. I mean, I rode the, Laird had the first board I ever saw, and I was on the second one I ever saw. And that was 12 years ago.
Bob then brought up a topic that seemed to be recurring with each of these interviews, and that is how to translate feedback from clients.
Yeah, I've been making boards with some of these guys like Flea. His dad and I are really good friends, and I remember Flea just was born, and you know, third, fourth birthday, you know, we started talking about the boards, you know, mm-hmm. and getting on boards at an early age, and through the years, you just. Yeah, like Flea and Barney, they're really good friends, and they both out there, they absolutely rip, but they're on radically different boards. Barney likes a real flat tail rocker, and Flea likes more tail kick. The tail kick turns tighter, quicker, easier, but the flatter tail gives you a lot more drive acceleration, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. so they all like these different styles. You go out surfing, they're doing the same thing, they like it, but he's got his design, and that's the nature of beasts. Everybody surfs a certain way, has their own style, and that dictates what kind of board they should get.
Right. And that's the shaper's job, I guess, to be able to translate, because they would both come in and say that they want maybe to do the same thing on the wave, but it's your job to kind of decipher how to give that to them, I guess.
Yeah, through communication, and then you get back, you make a board, and you get back in, and you say, all right, how's this board? Oh, I love this board. All right, good. Rate on 1 to 10. 10 being Mavic Perfect, 0 to 9. Oh, so there's a problem with it. It's a great board, but there's a problem. What's the problem? Well, no, there's no problem. Well, what'd you like better? And you talk, okay, possibly a little more drive. A little of this, a little more of that. I want to turn tighter. Get more of a vertical. Roundhouse cutback. I don't want to do a two-part turn. I want a three, you know, just a one-part turn all the way around. And, you know, there's different things you can do to achieve that. You know, to get that, you know, a little more tail kick. Pulled in the tail a little more and you'll get that, you know.
Yeah.
And so you just talk to the guy. What do you want? And there's a big variety of ways to get certain things. Certain things to... you do something, it'll be a positive or a negative with it. No matter what there is, there's always a positive or negative. But you try to keep the positive outnumbering the negatives in designing the board. You know. And what is really good is U.S. Blanks makes this. Makes such a big variety of blanks. It's all I need. I mean, they got the great short boards, fish, eggs, hybrid blanks. They've got the gun blanks that are perfect, a big variety, close tolerance. The foam is awesome. Lightweight, I can get lighter weight foam if I want, and real lightweight, I can get dense foam for the nose riders, a little heavier boards, you know, structural. Get whatever I want. So I'm very stoked on the U.S. blank relationship right now.
And then, of course, another recurring theme came up, the debate about machine-shaped boards versus hand-shaped.
And... We do a lot of boards here, and I'm busy. I have shapers that help me shape. I have a CNC machine, and these are all off of my things. And the CNC machines, some guys think it just pops out the board exactly what you want. It doesn't. I have one of the best machines they are, and I have my machine does a lot more passes, a lot more cuts, so it's a lot more accurate. But still, there's a lot of finishing in it. And if a quarter inch tolerance is good, then it's no problem. But I'm into a 32nd tolerance. 16th is a little too much. And so getting that tolerance just right, you got to get in there and shape it. And if I sign the board, I spent time on it.
Right.
Yeah.
That was going to be my next question, actually, was about the machine. Do clients have an opinion about the machine? Do they like it?
Oh, yeah, well, of course, everybody's got their opinion on what it is, what isn't, but a lot of people have no idea. It's like EPS foam. A lot of guys go, I don't want the EPS epoxy foam. I like fiberglass boards, you know. Everything's got fiberglass on it. People don't know. There's so much ignorance out there. So many people don't know. And they read this or they hear this. Oh, my neighbor says, oh, the magazine's saying. The magazine's written by a bunch of guys that don't know what they're talking about because they heard from their next door neighbor. You know, it's amazing what's out there. If someone thinks about the CNC, the bottom line is if I shape a board, and let's say I shape it for my buddy Jay Moriarty, and he rides this one, rides it through the years, all of a sudden he gets a board he absolutely loves, and his friends ride it, all of a sudden I find myself making that same board over and over again. I can take that magic board, scan it on my machine, it digitizes the tool path. Now I can put a blank up there, secure it really good, and my machine will duplicate that board within a 1/16 tolerance idea. Now that's real good. So I'm not starting with something that's so big. I'm starting with something that's real close to what I want. Mm-hmm. And then I get my calipers out and my measuring devices measured up, and it's faster. Mm-hmm. So I can get this magic board exactly what I want, significantly faster. Mm-hmm. But it's important that you have a good machine. A lot of these machines, I was one of the first guys in the world to have a machine, and I've had it for years. And you need damn near 2 forklifts to pick my machine up. It's real big. I can do 14-foot boards on it. And so there's a big variety. Some machines can only do like 8-foot boards, 9-foot boards. And my secure hold-down devices is, I've got a lot of them. A lot of guys say it's overkill. My machine is too big. It's too this, but it's not overkill. The more you hold that blank in a lot of different places, the secure it gives, your blank isn't flexing as the bit's cutting it. And so you get a more accurate shape. And in the beginning, when I first had the machine, a lot of my competitors are going, oh yeah, Pearson uses a shape machine. He doesn't hand shape anymore, which is bull. And the machine isn't bad. It repeats the same thing over and over again, which is bull. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of guys, they go, oh, I don't want to use a machine. These days, though, more and more people are using machines. They're understanding the advantages of them. So it's turning into more of a positive thing. But it's absolutely a positive thing. It's the way you can increase your production more accurately.
And it's more efficient use of your time and skill set. It's like anybody can cut out the outline of a blank. So why would you waste your time doing that? You know what I mean? I also feel like if you free up that time that you're wasting doing kind of the brainless stuff, it frees up your mind to explore new ideas, design ideas, or more shaping.
Yeah.
Or even spend more time with customers discussing it. You know,
That machine has freed me up. It's allowed me to increase my production, increase my accuracy. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
It's all a good thing. Yeah. I have all my riders, you know, they prefer, if they get a board, they know the advantage. If they get a board they really like, it goes on the machine. Mm-hmm. And then it spits it out like that for them, and they're stoked.
Right.
And all of a sudden, you know, they go, okay, I want to change this to this. You do it on the machine. You tweak it. You scale it. Right. You know, and it's easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the bottom line is, when those boards come off the machine, they don't go to the laminator. They go back into my shaping room, and I climb all over them.
Right.
And the game plan is always get a guy in a 10. I always rate it. So you like it? Yeah, it's great. I love it. All right, rate it. It's a 9. Well, at that point, I'm not happy. It's just, oh, it's the best board I ever had. All right, rate it. It's a 9. I go, wow, why isn't it a 10? So we get back in the room and do a 10. And I'm into that. Yeah. I get a 10. I'm going, all right, you're done. Let's get the next. Yeah. You know, so.
What's next? You know, what's on the horizon for you? Are you happy spending 7 days a week and surfing an hour a day, or do you see that changing? Or what's next?
No, yeah, I'm very passionate about this. I love this. I mean, I'll talk to 2 or 3 or 4 of my main riders today. You know, talk to Laird or Josh or Barney or you know Flea or some of these guys, and they'll call up this, and I'm stoked.
Yeah.
I'm fired up.
Yeah.
By the time I get off the phone, I can't wait to come in here and play.
Yeah.
You know, this is exciting stuff. I enjoy this. So this is good. Work, sure, it's work. Workaholic, yeah, but I'm playing. This is good. I'm excited. I'm passionate. You know, you get an artist in there painting and stuff. Is that work? Sure. But if he's really into it, and I'm really into this, then when I take this toy out and go ride it in the waves personally, And I'm out there with my friends on their toys.
Right.
And we got grin from ear to ear, and we're out there having all this fun. That's where it's at. I mean, it's just, I'm a pretty lucky boy to be in here playing like this.
Concludes this episode of Surf Splendor. Thanks for tuning in. Before we go, I'll share some information with you about upcoming shows. I received an email from Denton P, who mentioned that he likes the Shaper series, but he wants to hear more depth about design, theory, materials, etc. And I agree. I think that we're ready to go deeper, so look forward to that type of conversation with Shapers in future episodes. My email address is hello@surfsplendorpodcast.com. Feel free to share feedback and show ideas there. Also, the collaborative episodes with Scott Bass from Down the Line have gotten really positive feedback, so we'll continue to produce those. In a few days, we'll recap the Quicksilver Pro in France, which is currently underway. And then I think we're going to be doing a live, like host a live episode from the Boardroom Show, which is taking place in Costa Mesa, Orange County, California on October 5th and 6th. So look for that as well. And then if you'd like to continue this conversation, you can do so on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where our handle is @SurfSplendor. If you download from iTunes or Stitcher, make sure to rate the show and leave a review. It's really cool to see our little show climbing the ranks. And most importantly, we could use your help growing the show. And the easiest way to do so is to share it with a friend. Could you imagine if you just emailed our website to one friend or posted it on their Facebook wall? Our numbers could potentially double in 1 week. The more people listening, the more shows we'll produce. Shows are scheduled for every other Monday right now, but it'd be amazing if we could get it up to one episode a week. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you guys real soon.